but critics argue it intrudes on American public's privacy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story. The U.S. Senate has approved the extension of a controversial surveillance program, narrowly avoiding the program's midnight expiration. On Friday, 19th of April, the U.S. Senate late-night vote, 60-34, re-implemented Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, after the House passed the measure recently. The reauthorization ensures the preservation of what advocates consider a crucial component of the United States' foreign intelligence collection effort. Section 702 of FISA, which was initially established in response to the 11th of September 2001 suspicious attacks in New York and Washington, allows U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless electronic surveillance of foreigners outside of the United States. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said when voting on final passage began 15 minutes before the deadline, "In the nick of time, we are reauthorizing FISA right before it expires at midnight," adding, "All day long we persisted and we persisted in trying to reach a breakthrough, and in the end we have succeeded." Chuck Schumer claimed Democrats and Republicans came together and did the right thing for our country's safety. "We all know one thing, letting FISA expire would be dangerous. It's an important part of our national security to stop acts of terrorism, drug trafficking, and violent extremism. Both Republican and Democratic lawmakers have raised concerns about the alleged misuse of Section 702 of FISA, contending that it infringes upon the constitutional right to privacy of American citizens. The primary objective of this system is to oversee the exchange of emails and other forms of communication involving foreign nationals. However, it is possible that unintentionally messages from American citizens be intercepted if they're in contact with the individuals who are being monitored. Each year, hundreds of thousands of Americans' information is gathered during this process and subsequently accessed without a court warrant. The number of these searches has decreased from millions in previous years. Detractors label these searches as backdoor searches. The collection of information, which encompasses a significant amount of U.S. online activity, is designed to offer U.S. intelligence agencies expedited access to information concerning individuals from foreign nations. The legislation encountered opposition from House Republicans on three occasions within the last 5 months, resulting in its blockage. However, it eventually passed recently with a vote of 273 in favor, 147 against, after its duration was reduced from 5 years to 2 years. The program has garnered concerns from the White House, intelligence officials, and prominent members of the House Intelligence Committee regarding the dire consequences that may arise if it is not reauthorized. Despite constitutional protection, foreign nationals' privacy rights are compromised by the program, allowing data collection involving interactions with American citizens that can be accessed by domestic law enforcement agencies like the FBI without a court warrant, making it an intentional loophole for the government. A recent revelation says that the FBI employed this power to gather information on Black Lives Matter protesters, on donors to congressional campaigns and lawmakers in the United States, has increased doubts about the integrity of the program. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted in favor of a bill to renew the authority of a controversial surveillance program aimed at monitoring the electronic activities of individuals from other countries. The bill reauthorizing Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of FISA was approved on Friday, 12th of April, by the House in a vote of 273 in favor, 147 against. The approval was granted following the alteration of the bill's duration from 5 years, as initially proposed, to 2 years, which was requested by certain Republicans. Section 702 of FISA allows U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless electronic surveillance of foreigners outside of the United States. Its sole purpose is to monitor email traffic and other communications of foreign citizens, but American messages may inadvertently be intercepted if they're in communication with the individuals under surveillance. FISA, which was first created in the aftermath of the 11th of September 2001 attacks, has drawn scrutiny from members of both the Democratic and Republican parties, as they contend that it infringes upon the constitutional right to privacy of American citizens. The program's failure to be reauthorized has been cautioned against by the White House, by intelligence chiefs and top lawmakers on the House Intelligence Committee due to the potential for catastrophic consequences. Last December, a senior White House official stressed the importance of Congress renewing the program, citing the ongoing conflict in the Gaza Strip and also the Russia-Ukraine war, as well as the high tensions with China and the persistent threat of cyber attacks, making it a dangerous time for any kind of unilateral disarmament. Also, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden has expressed serious concerns about the legality of a secretive phone surveillance program funded by the White House to track trillions of domestic phone records every year across the United States. According to a letter sent by U.S. Senator Ron Wyden to the Department of Justice recently, the Data Analytical Services Program has been collecting information from countless phone calls nationwide. The mass surveillance program, formerly called Hemisphere, allows officials to simply ask for phone records of not only criminal suspects, but also their spouses, children, parents, and friends. In the letter obtained by technology news site Wired, Senator Ron Wyden warned that troubling information had been received would justifiably outrage many Americans and other members of Congress. Senator Ron Wyden added, "While I have long defended the government's need to protect classified sources and methods, this surveillance program is not classified and its existence has already been acknowledged by the Department of Justice in federal courts of law." Hemisphere was first exposed in a New York Times report in 2013. At the time, it was understood that the program was used solely for drug-related investigations.
Tonight on Exposé, better late than never. Western broadcast media appears to have realized the seriousness of a possible full-scale war with Iran as a result of Iran's calculated and precise instinctive retaliation to Zionist Israeli onslaught on its consulate in Damascus. With Iran's counterattack, Zionist Israel's long-standing claim of invincibility has crumbled as digital media highlights its incapacity to stop the Iranian strike or appropriately respond to it. And 71% of Zionist colonial settlers think Zionist Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should resign either immediately or right after the genocidal war on Gaza. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Iran launched more than 300 drones and missiles towards Zionist Israel on April 14 in its first full-scale military assault against the entity. As expected, U.S. military forces in the region helped the Israeli occupation intercept the strikes, yet they were still not fully successful in deterring Iranian retaliatory missiles and drones. Let us hear from Fuad Itaim, our broadcast expert, more about it in Fake News Exposé. In recent days, West Asia has been shaken by Iran's bold military retaliatory strike against Zionist Israel, marking a significant turning point in the region's geopolitical landscape. It seems that Iran's non-haste and precise instinctive retaliation to the uncalculated Zionist Israeli aggression on its consulate in Damascus has put the entire pro-genocide world on its feet, fully recognizing the gravity of a potential full-scale war with Iran. Fuad has so much to tell us about this past week's fake news expose. Floor is yours, Fuad.
Thank you, Marwa. Thank you for having me. So as we all know, the Iranian operation against Israel, dubbed the True Promise, was a response to the Zionist aggression on Iran's consulate in Damascus on the 1st of April and the martyrdom of Iranian military commanders and advisors. Mm-hmm. This operation has far-reaching implications that extend beyond mere military confrontation. But regarding the mainstream coverage of it, let's start with The Wall Street Journal's YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. Honestly, their explanation of why this attack happened seems like it's coming from a parallel universe. So mm-hmm. Let's listen.
Okay. It's how the conflict between the two countries escalated. Tensions in the Middle East had been building on several fronts. In addition to Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, there have been cross-border skirmishes between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, and attacks by Yemen's Houthi militia against Western interests in the Red Sea. Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthi rebels are all backed by Iran. On April 1st, an Iranian diplomatic building in Damascus was hit in what Iran says was an Israeli airstrike. The strike killed top Iranian military officials, including a senior member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps elite Quds Force. It was one of the highest-profile killings of Iranian military leaders in years.
First of all, saying what Iran says is an Israeli strike on the consulate is beyond mind-boggling, because the whole world knows that this was an Israeli strike. It's literally undisputable. Mm-hmm. Of course, barely any mention of the genocide in Gaza, which is what sparked the involvement of Iran and the resistance axis in the first place. Mm-hmm. WSJ tries to present the idea that Iran's proxies, like Ansarullah and Hezbollah, Ansarullah in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and their skirmishes with Israel are what led to this escalation. Mm-hmm. WSJ then tries to say that Iran threatened retaliation immediately, even though Israel hadn't confirmed the strike, as if it needs a confirmation. And the Israelis also spent 2 weeks after the strike saying that the building was a military site near the consulate and not mm-hmm. the consulate itself, mm-hmm. which was untrue, but basically shows you how they spent all this time trying to justify the attack. Mm-hmm. So you don't need any more confirmation than that, really.
Yeah.
Next, we have NBC News, mm-hmm. Who used its correspondent in Jerusalem, Richard Engel, to amplify the Zionist attempt to downplay the importance of this attack and its significance. So they claimed that Israel and its allies shot down all the Iranian drones and missiles immediately, which is untrue. Yes, there were projectiles that were intercepted, but the air defenses were in a complete frenzy. This was Iran's goal, using inexpensive projectiles to penetrate the layers of their defense systems. And they knew this would happen, and all the main missiles hit their targets mm-hmm. as they were supposed to, exactly as they were supposed to, including the intelligence and military sites that were directly linked to Israel's attack on the consulate in Damascus. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyway, here is what NBC's Engel said.
So the Israeli Air Force has already deployed. Its goal is to shoot down drones before they enter Israeli airspace. But Israel is not working alone. The Israeli media report that British and American aircraft have already begun shooting down some of the drones over Iraq and Syria.
So contrary to the Zionist narrative, the strike actually holds an immense military and strategic value. And it showcases Iran's capabilities and its resolve to defend its own interests and its allies in the region.
Yeah.
And its sovereignty, of course, because a consulate of a country is considered the sovereign territory of that country.
Because we're very much used to hearing Israel has a right to defend itself, but it's never other people when they are retaliating to the Israeli entity's aggression.
Exactly. Also, we have to remember that this was a limited operation, and Iran came out and said as much after the strike. This was a fraction of their capabilities, and it was a powerful message, because if it shows you, if this was limited, imagine what a wider scale attack would look like.
I am imagining liking.
This was already unprecedented, so imagine how much more unprecedented it would be. Next, we have Al Jazeera English, which unfortunately reinforces the Zionist narrative by downplaying the massive operation against Israel and its sensitive military sites.
I'm not even surprised.
It's very unsurprising, honestly, unfortunately. We're going to see how this is false in the upcoming digital mainstream media section with Julia, but for now, let's see what Al Jazeera said.
Okay.
Israel's military spokesman said the nation's defense systems detected incoming drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles launched from Iran and its proxies.
Together with our allies and partners across the region, we are operating at this very moment to defend Israel from Iran's attack. So far, we have intercepted the vast majority of incoming missiles by Israeli systems.
Many other mainstream Western media outlets also said after the Iranian operation that the world is now waiting for an Israeli response. Of course, completely ignoring the warnings of Iranian officials and the immense achievement that Iran has made by establishing this new equation and launching this historical operation from Iranian territory directly against the occupied lands.
Sure.
So with a move like this, Iran is capable of reshaping the global balance of power. And if Israel responds, it'll see something it has never seen before, something even more groundbreaking than this last operation. And this isn't me speaking. These are the words of the IRGC and the Iranian armed forces, and they should be taken seriously.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you very much, Fuad, for your analysis in the broadcast section. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to the digital mainstream media. Iran's strike is being viewed by all anti-genocide state and non-state actors, serving as a powerful assertion of its unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. By directly targeting the Israeli occupation with a projectile of advanced ballistic missiles, Iran has reaffirmed its commitment to standing alongside the Palestinian people in their struggle for justice and liberation. However, how did the Western and Zionist and even some Arab media platforms expose themselves by denying all of the above? Here is Julia Qasim, our digital media expert, with more.
Thanks, Marwa. Well, it's safe to say that the Zionist entity's decades-long boast and claims of invincibility has just been shattered in the matters of a night. So the Zionist regime's inability to prevent or adequately respond to the strike has exposed its vulnerabilities, leading to a decline in its perceived strength and credibility on the global stage. So in their reporting style, many print media outlets probably unintentionally told the story of the Iranian True Promise operation in a way that the ramifications of this historic event will continue to reverberate across the geopolitical landscape, shaping the dynamics of the region for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
So like the Washington Post, for example, which published on April 14th a piece entitled, "Why Did Iran Attack Israel? What to Know About the Strikes in the U.S. Response," by Neha Masih and Jennifer Hassan. So in this piece, the Washington Post reported that it was an unprecedented four-pronged attack against Israel. Quote, "Tehran's attack on Saturday was four-pronged, originating from sites in Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, called Tehran's attack more successful than we had expected and warned that any retaliation by Israel would draw a more forceful response."
Mm-hmm.
Then the Washington Post, in an attempt to show full coordination between the U.S. and Israel, posed the question, how is the U.S. involved? But rather ended up exposing the fact that the U.S. is not really looking for war with Iran, as per Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, who said, "We do not seek conflict with Iran, but we will not hesitate to act to protect our forces and support the defense of Israel." So meanwhile, Biden was quoted as saying, "No U.S. troops or facilities were targeted in the barrage. We will remain vigilant to all threats, and we will not hesitate to take all necessary action to protect our people." So the Washington Post also published an op-ed piece by Max Boot entitled, Now It's Up to Israel, De-escalate or Retaliate Against Iran, which frankly, in my opinion, ended up being just in favor of branding the Islamic Republic as fully committed to standing up alongside the Palestinian people in their struggle for justice and liberation. So this is evident in the exact paragraph where he says, quote, even nations that have been calling on Israel to implement a ceasefire and lessen civilian suffering rallied to its side on Saturday. House Republicans now say that they will rush a floor vote on long-delayed military aid to Israel. So, Marwa, this only proves that all of the Western countries are in reality pro-genocide and only voice concern when it messes with their respective public opinion, you know, back home.
And they say it's long-delayed when Israel literally received military aid in the middle of Ramadan to continue its genocide, which is totally also exposing their hypocrisy.
Exactly, because they'll say, like, they don't support the invasion of Rafah, but then they'll just fast-track more weapons to them at the same time.
Exactly.
And then, you know, this also further exposes Iran as being the only state in the region officially ready to engage in battle on the side of Palestine.
Definitely.
So, moving on to the BBC, which published a piece by Tom Spender entitled, What Was in Wave of Iranian Attacks and How Were They Thwarted? Where Spender discussed how at least 9 countries were involved in this brief yet unprecedented head-to-head operation between Iran and Israel, with the projectiles fired from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, as well as Lebanon, too, and allegedly downed by Israel, the U.S., the U.K., and France, as well as Jordan.
Well,
so in the BBC piece, Spender shows us how a few of the ballistic missiles got through and struck Israeli territory, as reported by the BBC correspondent covering the event at the time, by showcasing a map of the Nevatim Air Force Base in the Negev Desert in southern Israel, which was hit by Iranian missiles. So Spender then presents an infographic that portrays the range of the Iranian ballistic missiles, which ended up pushing the narrative that Iran holds immense military and strategic value, showcasing Iran's capabilities and tenacity to defend its interests and allies in the region, which easily covers the entire map of occupied Palestine.
And even goes beyond it.
Yes, and this doesn't even include their more advanced weaponry, which they're saving for later.
Like the hypersonic and others that we might not even know exist.
Right. Those are the ones that they're really scared of, Marwa. But Iran didn't even break those out. It was able to accomplish 1,100 kilometers plus of range with just, you know, older stockpiles.
Yeah. Well, we can't wait to see the newer stockpile. Thank you very much for being with us, Julia Qasim, our digital media expert, to explain what happened after the retaliatory attack on Zionist Israel. Now, ladies and just stay tuned because we will next move on to social media expose. Iran's retaliatory true promise attack on Zionist Israel drew applause from many Palestinians, whether in Gaza or in the entire historic Palestinian map, on Sunday as rare payback for the Israeli entity genocide on their enclave. Meanwhile, certain social media users from certain Arab countries, which acted as the first layer of defense for Zionist Israel, promoted the, foolish notion that Tehran had staged the assault more for a show than to inflict real damage. Here is Sima Itayim, our social media expert, with more.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Marwa. So it wasn't just Palestinians on social media who were ecstatic about the Iranian retaliation, but axis of resistance supporters all over the world, because for them, this was not just a legitimate response to the consulate attack. It was a clear demonstration of Iran's commitment to defending the oppressed and challenging imperialist aggression. And this garnered support and admiration from social media users and other like-minded entities. So beginning with the most widespread sentence on all social media platforms that we saw following Operation True Promise was, Iran has the right to defend itself, a sentence that's often used and famous for being used by Israel's allies in reference to Israel. And this is usually the sentence we all know when it comes to, you know. So we've witnessed this sentence being posted hundreds of times by, you know, hundreds of accounts and recorded and retweeted hundreds of thousands of times. So let's see a couple of examples of that. What the media hides posted, Iran has the right to defend itself from Israel. Do you agree? Rev Laskaris posting, Iran has the right to self-defense. Aya Hijazi posting, Iran has the right to defend itself. Gaza has the right to free itself from occupation. Palestine has the right to free itself from colonization. Israel has no right to occupy Gaza and no right to colonize Palestine. Then we have posts by Palestinians themselves in Gaza, as mentioned earlier, who were overjoyed to finally see missiles falling on the entity that has been committing incremental genocide mm-hmm. against them for the past 6 months, almost 7 months, as the world watches in real time. Mm-hmm. We have Aboud, the famous Aboud, the lovely...
I just love him.
...young Aboud, the Palestinian reporter who speaks to us from Gaza with his usual sense of humor and sarcasm and lightheartedness. He posted many videos of the missiles landing in occupied Palestine, and he said, "We thank Iran for this joy, which we have not heard since October 7." Mm-hmm. We go to Ahmad Hassan from Yemen, who decided to address those who rushed to, of course, downplay and belittle the event, mock it, and call it a theatrical performance. Ahmad posted, "The Arabs had 7 months to perform a play like Iran's, but they left the role of the hero in the play to Iran and insisted on playing the role of the scoundrel. Frankly, I liked the play and I liked the hero. Everyone's performance was fantastic. You are wonderful in your villainy and meanness, and Iran is wonderful in its heroism." Hmm? Then we have May from Lebanon, who shared a video show received from Gaza from a young man who was ecstatic to hear absolute silence for the first time in the skies of Gaza after six, almost 7 months of constant buzzing mm-hmm. of drones. May wrote, "After 190 nights, this is the first night that the skies in the Gaza Strip are calm. Children are spending a peaceful night without Israeli rocket explosions. Thank you, Iran."
Indeed.
And we finish off with the one and only Lucas Gage, mm-hmm. who is a former United States Marine Corps veteran, and he's famous for his animosity and rants about the genocidal Israeli entity. So Lucas posted during the Iranian retaliatory attack saying, "Iran's retaliation will have zero or very minimal civilian casualties, as they're trying to avoid harming non-combatants, like any honorable military would. Israel, however, has shown itself to be the world's most satanic military for what it did to the innocents in Gaza."
Amen to that. And I think that despite the fact that we tried to portray what social media was saying, I think just being alive at that moment and witnessing how social media was reacting in real time to this unprecedented retaliatory attack against Zionist Israel was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience for many of us. And I think we have a lot of more shows to talk basically about this issue. But I want to thank you very much, Seema, for showcasing for us the support that the Islamic Republic of Iran was garnering online. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned because next we have Figures Exposé. Opinion polls in Zionist Israel conducted last week have shown that nearly three-quarters of the Zionist public want Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign against the backdrop of the ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip, with half the country also preferring earlier elections for the Knesset. The Khan Public Broadcaster published surveys to coincide with the 6 month milestone since the genocidal war started on October 7. The polls showed the current government being ousted if elections were held immediately. Khan reported that 42% of respondents said Netanyahu should resign immediately and 29% that he should step down after the war concludes, making a total of 71% seeking his ouster. Of the rest, 21% said Netanyahu does not need to resign and 8% said they don't know. In addition, 44% said there should be elections within a few months, 22% want elections sometime over the coming year, and 26% said there should only be elections when they are next due in October 2026. Another 8% said they don't know. Mind you, these numbers were before the True Promise operation by Iran. I'm interested in seeing how fast Zionists are now ready to go to early elections after the utter failure of Netanyahu in last week's unprecedented Iranian slap in the Zionist face. Now let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. It was unforgettable. We never went to bed that night. The entire world was up waiting to witness history being made as footage began circulating from the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank and the occupied Al-Quds, showing many residents, including inside displacement tents, whistling and chanting Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest, in joy as the skies were lit up by Iranian missiles and Israeli entity interceptions.
Here is Nuha's voice from devotedly.yours telling it exactly as it is.
Yesterday, Iran defended itself by sending drones into Israel after Israel attacked an Iranian embassy in Syria. Now, it's very clear that Iran was just sending a warning to Israel, as most of these drones were intercepted, and they knew that was going to happen. The ones that were not intercepted hit military bases that were already evacuated. Regardless, it had Israeli settlers screaming while running for shelter. The fear that they felt in less than 24 hours doesn't even amount to 1% of the fear that Palestinians have dealt with in the last 6 months. Every single day, Palestinians are constantly under attack. Even though many Israeli soldiers were pulled out of Gaza because they knew Iran was going to attack, it did not stop them from continuing to bomb Gaza. What I would like to point out is, within the last 6 months, many Israelis have not only protested asking for their government to go harder on Gaza, they have also blocked humanitarian aid, saying that they deserve to starve. They have said that babies deserve to die because they would grow up to be terrorists. They have had convention attacks. At least in their situation, they had somewhere to run to for safety. At least in their situation, they don't have to worry about Iranian tanks in their streets. They don't have to worry about soldiers breaking into their homes, stripping the women, gagging the men, blindfolding them, taking them for weeks on end to torture them. They don't have to worry about starving to death. They don't have to worry about soldiers taking the women and doing you know what to them while making husbands watch and telling the husbands, if they look away, the husband and the wife will be shot to death. And they most certainly don't have to worry about being sniped while trying to return.
Ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. Well, I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom.
I wish both of you luck and success. God is very kind and so merciful, full of mercy towards us. Does he need my appreciation? Why do I have to worship? Like, we hear this question a lot from today's generation. Like, they keep saying that, okay, if God is that kind, if he loves me with no condition, then why do I have to go for praying? Why do I have to devote a special time for worship? Why?
No, that's a really good question. But first, can I bring the topic of why do we appreciate, even people, why do we appreciate them? Sometimes we appreciate for gratitude, for just for the sake of appreciating the other person's favor for us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we appreciate as a technique of receiving more. You do something good to me, I appreciate, and then
you're trading.
It's because I'm tricking you over this, and I want you to do something more for me. And sometimes, no, it's a technique for me to stay in the society, to follow the rules of morality, and to be a logical person who knows the thing that whatever you get, you need the whatever blessing you get, if it's about Allah, or whatever blessing you get, you need to appreciate for it. And there are too many reasons, like they are not necessarily about religion, they're not necessarily about Islam, it's about the God, the one who Allah, who made us, who created us, and we need to understand he doesn't need it. We are the people who need this appreciation for our own sake, for our improvement as human beings.
Now I come to ask then, why do I need it?
As a human being?
Yeah.
What is your purpose of life? Not you. I mean, what is the purpose of a human being?
What is the purpose of your life, sister? Studying for exams.
No.
Sleeping 2 hours a day.
One of our purposes is hosting this show.
Sorry.
One of our purposes is to achieve self-growth. Yeah. If you want to improve, you need to know the norms, the techniques. Mm-hmm. The techniques through achieving the life purpose are defined. You should know the norms. We should know the laws and the rules. And if you want to achieve that level of self-improvement and self-growth, you need to know the way. And this process, appreciation, is a technique, is a tool, is a device that is there for us, mm-hmm. for our improvement.
So, God has created me, mm-hmm. and brought me into this world. I know that for my betterment, for my improvement, I need to worship him. Mm-hmm. I need someone to resort to. And mm-hmm. who is going to be better than the one who created me?
Yeah.
So I have to appreciate him. In what ways can I appreciate whatever he has done to me?
Well, firstly, going off the back of what Sister was saying, there's a hadith that says that one who has not thanked the creation has not thanked the creator, right? So in order to worship
Allah... Like the other people.
Yeah. In order to worship Allah, and this is a bit of a profound thing I'm about to say, so bear with me. In order to worship Allah, you have to serve the creation to a lesser or greater extent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Allah likes it when we are good to other people, when we're kind to other people, when we appreciate other people, especially those who have done the most for us. For example, your parents.
Parents.
Why does Allah say so much in the Quran and in the Ahadith about parents, parents, parents? Because it is so easy to overlook the fact that your parents literally raised you. I wouldn't have raised you. Like your boss, for example, or your teacher, you give them so much appreciation because you're old and mature enough to recognize that this person is doing a favor to me. But these guys raised you when you were a nasty little baby and you used to poop your pants and you just had no, like, you just had no use except for eating all
good
of our
good for nothing.
Yeah. Right? They did that. Appreciation of them is appreciation of God. There was also a hadith from Prophet Musa alayhi salam. As you know, he's one of the great prophets of Allah, and he is known as the one who spoke to Allah. Mm-hmm. All the prophets pretty much spoke to Allah and were spoken to. But Musa alayhi salam is very unique because he used to have these special conversations with God. He used to ask questions that most of us wouldn't dare to ask. And most of us would think are silly questions that children would ask. Musa alayhi salam had the courage to ask them. And one of the things that he asked Allah is, "Oh Allah, what would you do if you were the creation?" Isn't that a really
nice question?
Yeah. Yeah? We would ask that when we were kids, right? That's something you would ask your parents, and your parents would be like, "Blasphemy! How dare you?" You know? No, he asked this question. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Ya Musa, I would serve the creation." That is a really, for me personally, that was really mm-hmm. life-changing hadith.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a direction. Look, I'm here amongst these other creatures. What's the best thing that I can do for everybody?
So helping other people is a way of showing my gratitude and my appreciation.
Sister, you're only here for a few moments, right? And then after this, you're going to go to your grave. You're going to be alone.
Yeah.
And inshallah, when you go to Jannah and everything else, you're going to have lots of people and a great social life, inshallah. But there is going to be a long, long, long moment which is completely alone. And at the end of the day, when you're sleeping, when you're in the bathroom, you are on your own.
Exactly.
You are a very lonely creature. And, you know, in night, you're going to be alone as well, inshallah. Mm-hmm. You have those solitary moments with your Lord, speaking to him in the night. You know.
Generally speaking, we're lonely travelers.
Yeah, generally. But
no matter how many people are there around us.
Yeah, it's just a very temporary thing, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You're going to spend some time with some people. What's the best thing that you can do with them? How can you maybe help them in some way?
So that was very nice. But I guess right now we have to go for a change of mood and then we'll be back. Following what you were just saying, there was a piece of a literary piece that I loved so much, and it said that in the end of the life, we're not going to be judged by the number of houses we got, or cars we bought, or documents that we have, certifications that we're going to get. We're going to be judged by the amount of humanity we shared with other people. Mm-hmm. The much of poverty that I tried to overcome,
yeah,
that I tried to help people to overcome, the much of broken hearts that I helped to mend themselves, and stuff like this. So you were just saying that helping other people, serving the creation of Allah, is going to be a way of showing my appreciation to God's blessings, to whatever blessing God has given to
me. See, my wife is really, God bless her, she's really giving. Almost too giving. It gets on my nerves sometimes because she's always saying, oh, this neighbor
so
needs this,
kind,
or, you know, those Taliban over there, let's give this.
Women
to
are just so kind.
God bless you,
yeah,
guys, you know.
Without us, you would have had this solid, stony
true
world.
Yeah. They have
with
this,
no colors, no emotions.
Yeah, they provide a lot of balance, alhamdulillah. But anyway, there's a hadith of the Prophet where he had some meat and he cut off a portion of it and he said, give this to so-and-so person, mm-hmm, or to a neighbor. And his wife said, oh, you know, we've given that away and we're only left with this much. The Prophet said, actually, it's the opposite.
Exactly.
That which we've given away is with us for eternity. That which we are now about to eat is just going to be consumed and it's going to disappear.
Yeah. So, yeah, Sister Nahid,
and this aspect is really important and needs to be taken into account, that Allah himself is self-sufficient. He doesn't need our gratitude.
Of course.
And the reason he's kind of advising us to be grateful is as a means of our own self-improvement and the benefits for us. He wants us to have a beneficial life. That's why he has advised us towards gratitude and appreciation. It's like we are appreciating him. We are following his order because he has also ordered to appreciate him as the Lord. Besides even appreciating the world around us, besides appreciating the creation, he has advised us to appreciate. And the reason is not like that he wants us as the creations. He doesn't want us to just say, thank you for making me, thank you for giving me everything. He doesn't want to hear these words. The reason is for him that he's so kind that he wants us to be more benefited, be
exactly
blessed.
And there's something actually I always think of. Out of all of these things that we experience in this world with all the difficulties and problems, there is something that is very clear. Even at the moment that you feel like you're so lonely, you can feel there is something. There is someone who's over there watching you. There's someone who cares too much for you. And I guess the idea behind him asking us to worship him is not just a matter of expecting him to reward us. It's not just that story. It's more of a love story.
Yeah,
I guess
it's a
the love and the bond, yes, that is the most important thing to
exactly
come out of all of those worships.
Exactly. That rapport is just leading us towards our life. That rapport is building our life through achieving the best thing possible, through achieving the correct relationship with the Creator.
Yeah, exactly. So out of these gratitudes and appreciations, we're going to gain a sort of connection, a bond, and a love that is never ending. And in that case, if you face too many problems, If you turn into a sailor at the just very middle of an ocean that is so stormy, then you're not going to care about anything except that you have the strongest, the almighty person with you, and you do not care for anything to come. So the whole idea of worship and appreciation and gratitude is to make us have a stronger feeling of love toward the one who created us, because this love is going to save us from all the miseries that we're going to suffer in this world.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, with my children, I always tell them to say thank you. My children are really young, yeah, right? They're under the age of 6. And I always tell them to say thank you when I give them something. It's not because I want to hear them saying thank you or because their thank you means anything to me. It's because I know that that's really important for their upbringing. And if they don't learn that from this age, they're just going to turn into these weird, selfish people.
And they don't forget that in all the cases.
I have to remind them, right? I have to remind them. Look, I have to go, mommy, so what do you say to mommy? And then they say thank you, right? The Holy Quran says, "Inna hadaynahu sabil, imma shakiran wa imma kafura." We've guided him to the path. He may be thankful or he may be kafura. He may be unthankful.
So we must teach ourselves, actually, to be grateful.
Yeah, so I want you to visualize a person, right? Two people, and they're each given an apple, okay? The first guy, he eats his apple. He doesn't say bismillah or anything. He just eats it and he chucks it, and he leaves a lot of it as well. The second one, he first looks at the apple. He appreciates the color of the apple. He smells the apple. Then he takes his first bite. He savors it. It takes him, like, a long time to finish this apple, but when he finishes it, he's so happy and grateful in his heart. Which one enjoyed the apple?
The second one, of
course. The second one. Why? This is one of the... You cannot be obedient to Allah except that you will be rewarded through it.
I guess that we have to nurture ourselves, to teach ourselves to be grateful people for whatever that other people do to us and for whatever blessing that God gives us. And this is very important, to not take things for granted, like anything that happens to you, it must have happened to you. No, it has been just a blessing given to you, and you should know the value and the worth of that thing. So this was all the time, and I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Migration is everybody's right. All people are free to look for some other places to reach their hopes and ambitions. From long ago, humans have searched for new places where they could live better. Today, you can achieve this aim more easily. People can immigrate to other countries to achieve their goals. Iran is a popular country among immigrants. There are those who may choose this country for their pursuing their education, as well as those who may find it a suitable place to live because of its weather, culture, and civilization. Dr. Orbadov spends her free time with her daughter. Like any other Iranian mother, she's concerned about her daughter's future. On the other hand, she's really happy that her daughter cares as much as about ethical and religious issues, especially that she has chosen to be a Muslim. She tries to take care of her daughter while her husband is studying abroad. She wants to make sure that her daughter doesn't feel her father's absence. They go shopping together, spend lots of their time with each other. They are like two good friends. She hopes that her daughter too can find the right path to happiness and fulfill her wishes in life. The classes are like spiritual trips for Raja. He draws passionately and teaches drawing with the same passion. He's been warmly accepted by his students. Being an immigrant hasn't been a problem for him. In his classes, Raja tries to practice exactly the way he has learned from his professors. He spends a lot of time and energy for his students.
I have a few students in my drawing classes. I can't rely on my teaching for a living. It's for recreation, not for money. This is how I keep myself in an environment that deals with art. Iran is far more progressive than my country in art, especially in graphics. Some Iranian painters and their works are at the global level. I have worked in some Arab countries too, but Iran is way more progressive in fields like poster design and illustration. In art, if you stop practicing for 3 to 6 months, it will be really hard to get back on the track. I'm now as involved in art as I was when I was doing my BA or MA. I see my old friends and I go to exhibitions with them. We sometimes meet in galleries like Saba, Khane Hunarmandan, or the Museum of Contemporary Art. I'll go to all new exhibitions with my friends or students. The more works you see and the more you are involved, the better results you will get.
Thank you.
book exhibition is a great chance for Fakhriye, and she spends lots of money on books. She wants to have a library with Persian books in Turkey.
There are Persian literature programs at universities in Turkey, and they need experts for them. I'm going to teach in one of those universities when I finish my studies.
When I was a freshman, it was really interesting for me to see that my teacher held my hand to draw, since I was not good at drawing. Mr. Mustafa Voti used to hold my hand and show me how to draw and how to move my hand. That motivated me to work harder.
Raja tries to learn as much as he can. He has devoted all his life to learn the art of painting and drawing. He has also learned Persian well to bring more depth to his art.
Besides drawing, graphic and artwork, I've translated 3 books into Urdu and I have made some money this way. So other than studying, I've been busy doing some other useful stuff. Iran, its people, the university and all, I know that I owe them a lot. Persian culture and its art are so rich that you can't give a full account of them in a short time.
He's trying to introduce the Persian culture to Pakistanis by translating some books from Persian into Urdu, and he considers it as his professional contribution. Raja is hopeful about his future. He also knows that he has a long way ahead.
I love mountain climbing